Welcome to the Claim Hunters. I am Chris Tidball, an executive claim consultant with Subro IQ, where we routinely find our clients significant amounts of trapped cash. On our show, we will explore the epidemic of trapped cash across not only the insurance industry, but the global business landscape. Our guests bring a unique perspective on challenges faced by businesses that impact their bottom line. We believe that everyone has a great story to tell, and this is the forum to tell it. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and stick around to learn more about how you can be a guest in 20 minutes or less. Welcome to the Claim Hunters. I am Chris Tidball, your host, and I am here with Brandon Shannon, who is an attorney with a law firm that has quite a long name, so I'll let you...
It is Boyer, Erickson, Baudette, and Trinnell, and none of them are easy to spell.
and I didn't want to mispronounce them. And you are out of Missoula, Montana?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so we're going to have some, you know, interesting discussion today on litigation management. Probably talk a little bit about Montana.
Absolutely.
So I have a client that called me up and said, I really need you to stop doing any subrogation in Montana. any particular reason why?
Well, it's a tricky place to subrogate. We've got we've got a true made whole rule.
Okay.
And so, you know, plaintiffs and their attorneys are typically going to stop you from subrogating unless you reimburse them for everything, including their attorney's fees, which is practically speaking almost impossible to make them whole under Montana law.
Right.
And so it's a difficult place to subrogate. It can be done, but it can be tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, one of the things when I think about, you know, calling lawyers in Montana, obviously, you know, litigation management, right? So you and your firm have really come up with some good litigation management guidelines. And, you know, if you could kind of share those, because I think, you know, a lot of folks sit back and, you know, everyone wants to handle their claims right. And you want to get the best possible outcome for everybody involved. And you really want to leverage your attorneys properly. So what are some of the things that you guys would recommend?
You know, our firm really focuses on taking an early look at cases and deciding which ones can be resolved early and which ones actually need to go into litigation.
Okay.
And I know that's a common talking point, but it is something that is actually really we focus on at our firm. And, you know, our idea is that even if we miss out on some billable hours on one claim, hopefully getting that case resolved efficiently will result in getting hired again.
Yeah. And I think there's a benefit to everybody to getting things resolved early. I mean, you know, when you have protracted litigation, I mean, the costs just go through the roof. I mean,
yes.
You know, it's what you do for a living. And, you know, you drag something out through a long trial and potentially appeals. I mean, we could have resolved this 3 years ago. Why didn't we? You know, what are the reasons you see that people are not trying to resolve things proactively?
You know, I think the biggest one is just attorneys get busy and they don't have time to put the actual effort into figuring out if the case can be resolved early.
Right.
And that's a place where the insurer litigation guidelines can kind of help attorneys out, right? If they have requirements that you need to have an initial case evaluation done in 45 to 60 days.
Right.
That's something that's not just kind of an obligation for the attorney to do, but it's really helpful for the attorney to sit down and do the work to, you know, fully evaluate liability and what we know about damages and what our opportunities to resolve the case are, whether it's, you know, we need to go mediate now or we need to get a dispositive motion filed and then mediate. And if you don't have the kind of the process where you sit down and you figure that out early, especially when you've got, you know, a big caseload and a lot of cases going on and things that get in the way, you know, you can kind of miss that. And that's where the insurer litigation guidelines can kind of help attorneys, manage their cases and not miss those early resolution opportunities.
Yeah. So what are some of the other guidelines that you guys are recommending?
You know, one of the things that we see as kind of a firm in a smaller jurisdiction, we do work for a lot of different insurers and they all have different litigation guidelines.
Right.
And it can be difficult administratively for us to keep track of, okay, This carrier wants a report within 10 days of us getting the claim file. This one wants us to do some investigation and wants a report within 60 days that's more complete and thorough. Or, you know, we take a deposition and this carrier wants a report within 5 days of that deposition. And this one wants us to wait until all the depositions are done. And then they want a complete report. And so one solution to that, that, you know, I don't think is in the works, but something that we would like to see is standardized guidelines that perhaps carriers could adopt and work off of.
Right. So is that something your firm has actually put together? So, you know, this is because, you know, one of the things we like to see on the carrier side is you want to see consistency, right? You give, you know, 100 adjusters the exact same claim, you want the same outcomes.
Right.
Because you have built processes in place to drive consistency.
Right.
And is that's really what you're driving towards on the legal side of the house?
Yes. And it's not something that we've formally done and said, you know, here's our you know, template guideline that we would like insurers to adopt, but it has happened kind of naturally in that we have some insurers that don't have any litigation guidelines. And and it's important for our firm that we are still, even for those carriers, doing initial evaluations and update reports.
Right.
And in the process of figuring out what to do for those carriers that don't have guidelines and don't necessarily know what they need or want, is we've kind of picked the ones that seem to work the best for both the attorneys and the adjusters, you know, and kind of combine those into, and that's that kind of set of guidelines is what we try to follow for, you know, companies that don't have guidelines. And that's kind of given us an idea of what we think kind of the best guidelines are.
No, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you want your litigation to be as efficient as possible and, you know, move that thing towards closure. And, you know, I think sitting down with folks and sharing your guidelines is a great idea. I don't know. Have you made your guidelines public?
You know, we have not. And it's, you know, something we could certainly do. I can talk kind of briefly about some of the guidelines that we think are the most ideal for both attorneys and insurers, and, you know, particularly with regard to time frames.
Yeah.
There's kind of this inherent conflict between attorneys always want more time,
right?
And they always want to draft more detailed reports,
right?
And the adjusters always want quicker reports with less details, and
right.
I think there's a good middle ground where, you know, you give the attorney the time to do the work to work the case up, but not, you know, give you a 5-page summary of how a short deposition went that the adjuster doesn't have time to read. And one of the things that we find is really helpful is to have a little bit longer time frame for the initial evaluation, because that's, you know, if you just have a week to review a claim file and draft up an initial evaluation, I mean, that really is the kind of communication that can be done with a phone call. You know, it's, hey, we're going to file an answer, we're going to send initial discovery, and then we're going to figure out where to go from here. But if you give attorneys a little more time, you know, 45 days, 60 days, maybe you can get some initial discovery responses back. You can actually review the medical records if there's damages issues in detail. If it's a construction defect case, you have time to actually get into the documents. And you can really, in 45 to 60 days, have a really good initial evaluation that gives the insurer and the attorney a good outline of, you know, where the case is going, and it sets good expectations of what liability is going to look like, what damages are going to look like, and really what needs to be done. You know, can you go mediate it now? What depositions do you need to take? What experts do you need? And that kind of time frame lets the attorney really communicate to the insurance company, the carrier, you know, what this case is going to look like.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Now, let me ask you, are you guys using any AI type tools to gain efficiencies to, you know, compress timeframes?
We are. In the last 6 months or so, we've kind of developed some internal AI guidelines, and we're working to make sure those comply with the carrier guidelines.
Okay.
But, you know, particularly with reporting, I have found that AI can save a lot of time, you know, with summarizing depositions and summarizing discovery. And it's not something where I would ever, you know, put it into AI, print out a summary and send it off to the company. You know, I still review it. If I took the deposition, I still add my thoughts, my impressions.
Yeah.
It's not just a summary of what the witness said, but kind of having AI do that initial summary and then me editing it is much more efficient than me drafting out the entire
Right.
summary.
Well, it's a tool to help you,
Yes.
right? So, I mean, you can get through things a little bit quicker.
Yes.
And, of that, 45 to 60 days of the initial review, you're freeing up a lot of your own time to actually focus on the investigative piece,
Yes.
which is important.
It is. And the AI piece too is another piece where, carriers need to recognize that perhaps timeframes need to be adjusted a
Right.
bit, particularly with regard to deposition summaries. I mean,
Yeah.
if you have a requirement of a report 5 or 10 days after a deposition, it's very unlikely that I'll have the transcript at that point.
Right.
And so I'm not going to be able to use AI to make that more efficient. And if you bump that deadline out a little bit, then I can get the transcript in and use AI, and be more efficient about drafting the report and spend more of my time telling you the impact of that deposition, which is really what you're paying the attorney for.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So other guidelines you'd share.
The initial evaluation is really
Yeah.
important. And then, the status reports along the way, we talked about the depositions. Written discovery too is another one where having a little bit more time helps the attorney, particularly in personal injury cases. If
Right.
when the requirement is that, you have a report to the carrier 5 or 10 days after you get the plaintiff's discovery responses in, if there's medical records involved, the chances of me being able to get a paralegal to do a chronology or summary and then me review that and some of the key records
Right.
in 5 or 10 days, it's just very unlikely that I'll be able to do that, even if we're using AI to assist.
Yeah. Because I was, yeah, there are some good summarization tools out there that,
Yes.
they can kind of organize, sort, index, and compile everything, run through the
Yes.
medical records, look for the, I mean, you see the games, the upcoding, the unbundling, the modifier, I mean, all the stuff that we see
Yes.
out there that, and it takes a lot of time to get through that, right?
It
I mean,
does.
you've got 100 lines of codes to go through, and it's not an instant process.
Yes, and AI can make it much more efficient because it can organize the things for you, it can create summaries, but it's still the best way to catch important issues is for the attorney to be looking at those records themselves. And
Yep.
AI can help you do that more efficiently, but still it's not something that can be done quickly.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So another Montana question for you.
Yes.
So there's a big brouhaha out in California right now.
Okay.
People with money are coming to Montana to buy cars.
Yes.
And there's a reason, I guess, and part of that's probably to not have to pay California sales tax and registration fees and all that. What's the deal with Montana and cars?
Yeah, so my understanding is that we have really low registration costs
Okay.
and there's no sales tax.
Okay.
And so people do, they'll set up an LLC in Montana and they'll purchase a vehicle or a tour bus or an RV with that
Okay.
LLC, and then they can avoid paying sales tax and then they get our low registration fees. And that is completely legal to do in Montana. I know
Okay.
some attorneys that is their entire practice is doing that.
Really? Setting up an LLC in Montana.
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't think that the states where those folks are avoiding paying taxes and registration fees appreciate that too much. And so they can get in trouble with their home states. But,
Yeah.
as someone from Montana, that's not, I don't worry too much about that.
I mean, it's interesting because if you have an LLC in Montana, I mean, that's a legal business enterprise,
It is.
right? I mean, you're a business owner in Montana, you're paying whatever taxes and fees are owed to that state. So why couldn't you get a car and license it in Montana? It seems to make sense. It seems like a good business practice.
Yes, and I certainly don't have any problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, if I had the money to buy a Lambo, I'd probably do the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Or
Although,
a tour bus or a big
yeah.
RV. I mean, that's where we see them a lot is, and I wish I could remember off the top of my head, but there's been quite a few really famous bands over the years that their tour buses have had
Really?
Montana plates on them, and
Yeah.
that's why.
Yeah, and you see Montana tags now and again. And it's kind of rare, especially down here. I mean, we're really far from Montana. California's kind of close, but it's always on high-end cars.
Yes, and that's probably why someone doesn't want to pay the sales tax on that.
Well, so no sales tax in Montana. That's a nice perk.
Yes, it is.
Do you have other taxes
We
or?
do. We have property taxes,
Okay.
With kind of COVID and people being able to work remotely, that's become a pinch point in Montana, because our property values have gone up a lot,
Oh, yeah.
like a lot of rural places,
Sure.
because people can work remotely, and why not live in a beautiful place if you can? And
Yeah.
that's kind of driven our property values up and our property taxes up, and created some problems.
It is a beautiful state. It's I've been a couple times, and it is one of the most, most beautiful. So Brandon, thank you for coming on our show, and it was great to meet you. And if people wanted to learn more about your firm, how would they go about doing that?
The easiest way is our website. It's
Okay.
bebtlaw.com.
Okay.
And we do coverage and defense work in the entire state of Montana. And Chris, thank you so much for having me on. It's
Absolutely.
been a real pleasure. Like I mentioned, I've never been on a podcast before, but it was really
Yeah,
fun.
great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining the Claim Hunters. We hope you enjoyed our show. If you would like to share your story, head on over to subroiq.com and click the YouTube button.